Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 27th, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Roberta Bondi. Today's session number is 98-6, and it is titled Memories of God, Knowing God. Let's listen in.
I'm Roberta Bondi, and this week I will be talking 4 days of the week on various issues around the intersection of personal experience and Christian doctrine. And I'm going to do it topically. Now, I can tell you what three of the topics are, and I'm still deciding on the fourth topic. Today's session will be on Christian reason and how we think about God. Tomorrow's session will be thinking about God as mother. Another session will be on the crucifixion, and then I'm trying to decide on between two more other topics. Now, I'm using material from this book called Memories of God. Actually, the one that was supposed to be in the bookstore looked like this. It's a hardback, but this is the English edition, is in paperback. But unfortunately, I ordered 25 copies for the bookstore, and the bookstore didn't think it would sell them, so it didn't order that many, and they're all sold out. So,
I bought the last one.
You bought the last one? So I'm sorry. You can get it fairly easily. You can have a bookstore order it for you when you get home if you want it. It's Abingdon Press, which is the Methodist press, like Augsburg Fortress is the Lutheran press. Now, this copy that I have right here came from the library, and somebody handed it to me as he was getting on the bus Sunday and said, I checked this out from the library, but since you wrote it, you'll know what to do with it. So I haven't actually the foggiest idea. It looks like it's been actually checked out. But if anybody wants to take this one and check it back in and then check it out, you're certainly welcome to do that.
Actually, I think it's supposed to be on reserve.
It's supposed to be on reserve. Well, maybe we could put it back on reserve. That would probably be a good idea. What I have to say, let me ask you all this before we get started. Was anybody here last week for the sessions last week? One session. One session is enough. That's. I'll say that the material that I worked with last week, I'm accustomed to teaching. I teach that stuff at school, and I lead retreats on it. And the material we're using today, I don't normally teach. Now, it is true that I did write the book, and I definitely think it's important, but it's going to be more experimental how we work with it. And my flute teacher, I'm a terrible flute teacher, flute player, but my flute teacher always says, don't ever apologize in advance. So I realize I am apologizing in advance, but I can't help it, so y'all can just do what you want to with that. Now, let me say a few things about how we're going to do things this week. I think in order to tell you something about how we're going to do things, I may have to just jump right in. I'll tell you that a lot of what we're going to do this week is going to be telling stories. And I will be talking autobiographically a good deal of the time. That's what that book is. But the purpose of this is not, I just had the most fascinating, wonderful life, and I'm just an inspiration to everybody. This is not the point of this. The point is that you listen to these stories and you hear how they are similar or different from your own stories, and use these to start thinking about what are these Christian doctrines about. So they're sort of pump priming stories. You know, and their stories. One of the things when I was in seminary, and I'm going to come back to this in a minute, but when I was in the seminary in the 60s, up until that time, I had been a person who really lived by stories. I was a shy, difficult, in many ways obnoxious child, and who couldn't ever quite fit into things. But I consoled myself by reading stories, and stories presented an alternative universe, as well as giving me a tool for understanding the universe that I lived in, that just was baffling, you know, a lot of the time. And I was an English major in college, you know, which is a natural sort of thing for people who like stories to major in. But then I got to seminary where I was taught that theology has nothing to do with stories, that real thought is always abstract and universal and not particular, and that the opposite of all those things was subjectivity and emotionalism and a kind of particularity that was completely untrustworthy when it came to trying to apply it to anybody else. You know, I mean, it might be okay for you, but it was so subjective that there's no point in talking about your experience if you're talking about theology. Now, that's the way it was in the 60s. I'm sorry to tell you, that's the way it was. And my own theological training was that way. So in order to be trained theologically, I had to unlearn or try to unlearn a whole lot, not just about how I thought, but of who I was. And then once I got through with my graduate work, graduate school is a great struggle. I'll get sort of do this more systematically in a few minutes. I had to relearn what I knew as a child in order to teach, because I became convinced that stories are the way we learn, and that theology is about stories, the telling of stories, and that there is no way we can kind of take in and make our own these great Christian doctrines unless we really can see how they intersect with our lives, how they are in fact sort of shorthand statements that are expanded into the stories of our lives. So that's what I want us to be doing this week, is I'm going to be looking at these topics, four topics, kind of narratively, but looking at them as we look at them narratively as the way that they are also expressions of theology. And I'm hoping that it will help get a grasp on how to do a kind of theological thinking that is, I think, what we really need right now in our churches. You know, less abstract, more intersection. Okay, so let me also say that it is always my policy when I teach to assume that people are going to ask questions, and that you don't have to wait politely till the end, you know, but you just ask a question whenever it comes up. And if you ask something that I'm going to answer later, I will say, well, if you can hold it for a few minutes, we will get back to that. And if you say, I can't wait, I'm going to have a heart attack or a stroke right here on the floor, right at this very minute, then I will do my best. And then we will apply emergency first aid and do our best. So I never, you know, it's very unusual for me to have audiences or classes that just sort of sit there and take it, so to speak. Okay? So let me start here. And as I said, it doesn't hurt for you to be thinking as you hear this, you know, let your imagination kind of go with, how is this connected with my own experience? Because the point, one of the points that I haven't made that I want to say also, is that in my relearning what I knew as a child about the importance of storytelling, is when I also came consciously to understand that the thing about a story that is so wonderful is that it's both particular, it's my story or your story, but it's everybody's story. I mean, stories function in such a way that they overcome that gap between the personal and private on this side, and the universal applies to everybody but don't get particular on this side. They overcome that gap. So let these stories do that for you, I hope. When I was in the fourth grade, I remember having a rather traumatic experience one day when I went to the movie that my class always used to go to on Wednesday in the school auditorium. And we always would have classes, we'd always go see these movies, and they were usually on industry of one sort or another. And all the kids in all the fourth grade and fifth grade classes would go, and we'd sit in the dark and in a room that essentially smelled like erasers and little kids. And we see on this in this darkened room this huge screen that would be full of machinery making sort of pounding noises and inspiring with inspiring music in the background. And I remember, for example, one movie in which there was a it was on wheat growing in the Midwest or in the and it was and I remember a sort of a giant farmer striding across the screen wearing a uniform of some sort, said Fred or something on his pocket. And it always talked about the progress that mankind is making. It was always put in terms of mankind. Well, this particular day that I'm remembering, it was a movie on coal mining. And I remember they're always full of massive machinery. I remember the giant drill and all of the stuff and the music. And we got to the end and it was time for questions. And various children asked various different questions. And the movie had started with a statement that coal came from, prehistoric time, from the age of the dinosaurs. And it was essentially made out of, compressed dinosaurs and ancient ferns and that sort of thing. And all of a sudden it struck me during this question and answer period that if it was made out of compressed dinosaurs, there weren't any more dinosaurs. And so I put my hand up in the air and I said, aren't we going to run out of coal if there are no more dinosaurs? And the teacher essentially said, of course we're not going to run out of coal. Now shut up and sit down and mind your own business. That was a sort of... that's one story. And I remember being horribly humiliated by all that. But I also remember a friend's mother had an accident when I was a kid. And it occurred to me around the same time, maybe I was a little older. I think it was the first time it really occurred to me that my mother could also have an accident. And this other child's mother didn't die, but she came very close. And it was enough for me to know that my mother could die. So I remember asking her, Mama, what would happen to us if you died? And her answer was, I'm not going to die until I'm a very old lady. Now, children don't have to worry about that. And I said, yes, but Mama, what about Betty's mother? And then she gave the answer that all mothers give in this situation, which is, I told you I'm not going to die. Now, what you need to do is go out and play and get some fresh air. these are the sorts of things that we heard as children. Believe this because the adults are saying it to us. Believe it. And in the spiritual life, it was similar, only maybe in some ways worse. I remember going, religion was not something we talked about in my house much as a child, because my father was a cynical atheist. That was his religion, cynical atheist. And my mother was Southern Baptist. But my mother also believed that women should not argue with their husbands. I think my father believed this too. My mother definitely believed it. So she handled this by simply taking the children, me and my two brothers, to visit in Union County, Kentucky in the summer during revivals. And so we got most of our religious education around adults from revivals. Now, she also took us to Sunday school, to the nearest church while we were growing up, but it was summer revivals at Pontfort Baptist Church that really had the impact. And so that the religious teaching I got in summer revivals in Pontfort Baptist Church essentially went like this. Now, remember that revivals are intended to bring people to conversion. So you can probably go to a church for a year, or you could back then in the 40s, and never hear hell mentioned. But boy, when you go to summer revival, it's a different matter. So the preacher would always preach the same sermon every year, with the occasional slight variation in the jokes. he used different scripture texts, but they'd always come out the same, you know. And it was always, he'd start, you know, kind of slow, and then he'd work up. And, you know, and he, about the middle, he'd start really thundering about sin and how you're all sinners and all going to hell and all and so forth. And then he'd start preaching John 3:16. And so first he would let everybody know that God was just so mad, you know, that God was beside God's self. And then he would start preaching how much God loved us and that enough to send his son to die for us. And what we were supposed to respond with was belief in God's love. Only believe God loves you. Now, this is not the words that he must have said, but this is the way I carried it out of my childhood. Only believe God loves you or he'll send you to hell forever. So the message that I heard in there, I connected with you know, going to the movie, the conversation with my mother about whether she's going to die, and myriad other conversations with adults in my childhood, in which it seemed like what I was being asked to do was believe against my own experience and my own common sense and my own reason. I mean, a fourth grader is smart enough to know that her mother can't tell her for sure, I promise I won't die until I'm an old woman. You know, children are smart enough to know that you can't promise that. You know, you really can't. So it seemed to me that if belief and believing the things we were told was a major issue for children in the secular world, so to speak, in the religious world, it seemed like it was even doubly so. Believe God loves you, or he'll send you to hell. I mean, now I'm paraphrasing that, and it kind of sounds kind of funny, but that was pretty literally what the message was. And this might have been okay, except for children are also smart enough to know that a God who would tell you that he's going to send you to hell if you don't believe he loves you is a pretty tough God to love, and to believe loves you. So I had a great deal of difficulty with that. So I spent a lot of my childhood having terrible nightmares about the way I was going to go to hell, because I could believe that part without any trouble. But if I couldn't believe God loved me, he would send me to hell. But I could not, for the life of me, believe that God loved me. There were lots of reasons for this. And one of the reasons was because all of us learn our something of who God is. We get our most primal images of God, I think, from the people who are our nurturers as children. And I grew up in a home with a father who did indeed love me, but I didn't know it because he was so perfectionistic. And my parents were married very young. Be like, that sounds great as a theory, but what do you do with parents who have one child, an only child, who is dying of a terrible disease? And do you just say, well, they shouldn't be upset. Death is just a natural part of life. You know, that's not the way we experience things. And that's not the way we should be asked to experience things for the sake of rationality. So there was a whole series of things like that just, that this kind of rationalism was not good with ambiguity, and it was not good with human pain. And so that was disturbing to me. Okay, somehow or other, well, I know how I did it, but I will tell you how I did it. Okay, I ended up in seminary, which seems like the last place on earth I would ever end up. In the early 60s. And I ended up in seminary in the following way. I was a student at SMU, and I graduated from SMU with a degree in English, and I was about to start a graduate degree in English literature. Back in the olden days, when I had gone to the summer revivals, I had also gone to Vacation Bible School in the daytime. Now, at night, when I go to the summer revivals, what I would hear about is hell and how Jesus was going to send us all to hell if we didn't, you know, shape up and so forth. But Vacation Bible School was all Old Testament stories, and they all had happy endings. They were always about somebody or other being rescued by God from slavery, or Isaac being rescued from Abraham. I never paid attention to why Abraham was chasing Isaac in the first place. That sort of thing. So I love the Old Testament stories, which all seem to have happy endings. The God of the Old Testament seemed to me to be a God of love, and the God of the New Testament, the God of wrath. So I decided I was going to do graduate work in English, and I was interested in English Renaissance poetry particularly, and I was interested in the use of Old Testament material in the Renaissance poetry. So I thought, okay, I have a summer between my last year in college and my first year in graduate work. I'll go learn Hebrew at the seminary. I'll talk somebody into letting me teach myself and to monitor me. So I went out and I got a copy. I talked to one of my professors, and I got a copy of Learning Hebrew by the Inductive Method. And I got a copy of the Old Testament in Hebrew. And I thought, this will be interesting. Now, learning Hebrew by the Inductive Method in that old approach, you start on the very first day with the first words of Genesis. You don't, do grammar for 6 months and then get to it. You start from the beginning. So I got my grammar book out, my instruction book out, and I studied that. And then I got my Hebrew Bible out, and I opened it, and I looked at the page at the first words, and they said, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." And I'm looking at these Hebrew letters, and it's like they're full of little flames. You know, this is the most wonderful, beautiful thing I had ever experienced in my life. It was like all of a sudden God cut right through all that childhood misery and all that teenage misery, and here was a God I'd never seen before. You know, one who created the world and loved it. Well, I was a part of it. Now, I didn't have any idea, where any of this would go. But in that moment, I said to myself, I'm quitting English, I'm going to do Hebrew. And so I did. I dropped out of graduate school, and I applied to seminary that very day and decided I never intended to go into ministry, but I thought, I'm going to study Hebrew the rest of my life. This is what I want to do. I can, on occasion, be impulsive. You may have a hard time believing that. But in fact, it's true, I can be impulsive. And so I spent my seminary years just mostly reading Hebrew and Aramaic and a little bit of Greek. But Greek I read reluctantly. That was the language of the New Testament. I wanted the God of the Old Testament, who was the God of love. So then I went off to graduate school in England at Oxford, and I did a graduate degree in Semitic languages and Hebrew. And it came to be time to do my PhD dissertation. Now, up until this time, I had not talked to anybody about that first experience that I had with Hebrew. I'd never told anybody that. I had continued to love Hebrew, but that God had kind of receded a little bit under the pressure of studying and grades and all that kind of stuff. But I had loved Hebrew throughout my graduate work, even though I had struggled with it. And it got to be time to do a dissertation, and I decided that I wouldn't do one in Old Testament, because if I did it in Old Testament, Old Testament is a kind of, the biblical disciplines are kind of odd, in the sense that they got only small books to work on. And so there's no way, if you're a scholar in that field, not to spend most of your time actually reading secondary sources, reading books about the Old Testament or the New Testament. I thought, heck, I don't want to do this. You know, I like to read the primary stuff. I want to read the ancient stuff. So I thought, okay, I will do it in Syriac. Now, Syriac is a branch of Aramaic that was spoken really quite early, but there's a lot of literature from about the 4th century to the 8th century. I thought, well, there aren't that many people working in Syriac. It's a Semitic language. It's one of the languages I've studied. I'll work on Syriac texts. Makes sense. Then that way I can spend all my time reading texts. Well, what I knew in my head but didn't pay any attention to was until after I'd committed myself to this, was the fact that all those texts were Christian. And I was going to have to be reading Christian texts. And that I was going to not only have to be doing it during my graduate work, I was committing the rest of my life to doing this. Well, this was not good news. But I went to the library and I worked for months reading these big stacks of books trying to find a dissertation topic in Syriac, and they were all Christian, and it seemed like one was worse than the next in terms of, you know, what we do is we read through the lenses that we have, right? So I could not hear past what I'd heard as a child, to hear what was actually in those texts. All I could hear was what I'd heard in the child. The rest of it I just filtered out. But one day when I was really, really discouraged, it was a terrible day, I went, you know, and I sat down in the library and I had this stack of books in front of me, and I picked one up off the top and I opened it in the middle, and it was a book on, it was called, get this, you'll love this title, just makes your mouth water, The 13 Ascetical Homilies of Philoxenus of Nabuc. So I pick up the 13 Ascetical Homilies of Philoxenus of Nabuc. It's about 950 pages. And I sigh and I open in the middle. And I open to a text, a sermon on the dangers of judgmentalism. And it's directed at monks and it warns monks that they are not to judge each other because they are to be like God, who always sees us with far more mercy and compassion than we ever, ever see ourselves or each other, and that therefore we must not be judgmental. Well, this may not sound like much, but this was just the overturning of, I thought, I immediately, you know, in 1 minute I knew, if this is true, everything I know is wrong. You know, the whole world is different from what I've already always thought it was. And I have a different place in this. And I remember just sitting there and just crying, having to get up and go walk around outside and then come back and just being sort of stunned by the thought that God might see us more compassionately than we see each other or ourselves. And I said to myself, if this is true, then what am I going to do? Everything is different. But one of the things I did say is, this is the person I'm going to work on for my dissertation. And so I did. And everything started out well enough, though I did have to talk them into letting me work on Philoxenus, and they didn't let me actually work on his so-called ascetical writings. I had to work on his doctrine of Christ instead, because that was serious. This other was not serious. But everything, it was hard. The texts were hard. There's lots of Syriac. And I still didn't regard myself as a Christian. I thought, okay, I can work on this Christology, on the doctrine of Christ, because I'm not a Christian anyway. I'm a scholar of languages and a historian, and so I don't care, you know, how this controversy that he was engaged in came out. I don't have anything at stake here. So I worked on it for several months, and then I got up one day and I could not work. I could not translate, I could not think. I sat there and I looked at the page and I couldn't do it. Well, this went on for about 6 weeks, and I started getting frantic. And I didn't know what was wrong, you know, I couldn't figure out what was wrong. So I went and I talked to a man whom I knew, who was an Episcopal priest, and I don't even know what it was that made me talk to him, because I didn't know him that well. And as a matter of fact, I didn't even very much like him. But I told him that this was happening, and he said, "What you need is a rest." I said, "I'll try anything." So he says, "Well, I know of a convent here in Oxford, an Episcopal Benedictine convent, and you can just go there and stay for about 3 days, and that'll be good for you. You can just rest." So I said, "Okay, I'll try." So I got all bundled up. He made the arrangements, and I went out on the bus to the convent. And I remember I got there, and it was a really cold day, and I was met at the gate by an oblate, a little short woman in a brown habit, who led me in and took me up to the room I was going to stay in. And I was so tired, and I hadn't even realized that I lay down on the bed in my coat and hat and boots and gloves and scarf and everything. I just lay down on top of it and instantly fell asleep. And at some point, and I have no idea how long it was because I slept so hard, the Mother Superior came in. And it was her custom to greet guests. And she came in, and I leaped off the bed from a sound sleep, and she gave me the kiss of peace, at which point I just collapsed on her, you know, in all this wool clothes, and just started sobbing hysterically. And she took this very well. She added me, you know, oh, please God rescue me from the crazy lady. But she said, "What's wrong?" which was a logical thing to say under the circumstances. And I found myself telling her about the material I was working on. I don't think it was clear to me until that moment what the problem was. And what it was that I had gotten so far involved in the Christological controversies, in the debates in the early church about Christology, that what I realized at some point deep in my gut, that I might get to the end of working through all this stuff and I would say, none of that's plausible. This is all just hogwash. Now, that might have been all right to get to the end and say, this is all hogwash. But this other insight about who God was so important to me that if I did say that, I would have to give this up too. And I was in a quandary, you know. So what I was dealing with was three overlapping concepts of God, wasn't it? I had my childhood only belief sort of Christianity, and God only loves you if you believe what you're told. And then I had the Unitarian childhood rationalism. It's all rationalistic, it's all rational, it doesn't involve an emotional commitment at all. And then I had what I first met in my first glimpse of Hebrew, which was then picked up in this Philoxenus, you know, whom I'd met later. And I had all three there right together, and I realized that my life was at stake and how that came out. And it was an emotional problem, but it was also a thinking problem, you know, it was a rational problem. What do I do with this? Well, the Mother Superior was wonderful. She just let me say all this, which didn't actually take very long, surprising to say. And she just looked at me and she said, "Never be afraid to use your mind." The God who created you is the God who gave you your mind. Never be afraid to go all the way to the end of any problem with your mind. And it was just wonderful. It was this huge weight lifted off of me, and I realized that I could use my mind, and that if God really was the God that I was meeting in the new text that I was reading, that this would surely be the case, and that I should not be afraid to question and push, and that believing was not the solution to any question. And I realized as an adult, as I continue to think about this, I think about Jesus's parables and the way Jesus actually taught, you know. Jesus's parables are designed to make people ask questions, you know, question the deepest things they believe. and to, you know, to sort of unravel the very structures that hold them together, and to look and see if that was really true or not. Now, something else that I learned in that experience that I never forgot, and this was again supported by the material from the early church. Part of the part of what I had learned in seminary and from my Unitarian friends, and had continued to be the absolute backbone of my education at Oxford, is the fact that that emotion and rationality are enemies. That if you're going to be objective, you can't have feelings about it. I mean, a real scholar. I remember one time I was writing an essay in Oxford for my tutor, and I was, the way tutorials worked is you were assigned an essay once a week, and then you went and you read it to your tutor, and he corrected it. So I was reading my essay, and I was reading along, and I said, "Scholars feel such and such and such and such." And he said, "What did you say?" And I said, "What? What? What did I say?" And I said, "It says here in my essay, scholars feel such a..." I said, "What's the matter?" He said, "Scholars never feel. Scholars think." Now that was just sort of paradigmatic. You know? You got your choice. You can think or you can feel. You can't do both. Thinking is objective, you know, rational, universal, trustworthy. You know, emotionalism or anything connected with emotion is untrustworthy, subjective, superstitious. Now there is one other trick to all this too, as I learned all this in high school and college and seminary and register, and that is, in the world of that time, rationalism was connected with guess which gender. And emotionalism was connected with guess which gender. Women were not supposed to think, be able to think, because they were an emotional lie. You know, unlike men. And so all this was also reinforced that way, which also created a division in myself, against myself. Now, one of the wonderful things in the ancient Christian texts that I took me a long time before this one filtered through to me, but it was really important when it did, is that we've made that distinction between emotion and reason pretty much since the 18th century. That's pretty much a new thing. In those ancient Christian texts, which were drawing on a tradition of Platonic thought as well as biblical thought, but this is also true for the Bible, I mean, so you can't just say it. Emotion and reason were not played off over against each other. It was assumed that because God is love and God is also reason, the Word made flesh, there's no opposition there. And that, in fact, to make a statement like, "Why are you feeling sorry for those people? It's just not rational," would be an impossible thing for a Christian of the creed that I work on to say, because rationality is an expression of who God is, and God is love. So it's not possible to be rational and to be hard-hearted at the same time. It's not possible, because our reason is not freestanding, something that exists for its own sake, but is in the service of love. Who is God, and God is love. And that's what was sort of brought home to me in that convent, and then I was able to see that in this text. But that becomes really an important issue then, that makes it possible theologically to say, of course we claim our own stories when we do theology. We don't have to say, "I have to lay those aside so I can be rational." That's who we are. You know, they come together. And that growth in the Christian life is about the integration of reason and emotion and long-term stuff and short-term stuff. It's about the integration of what is universally true and the claiming of our particular experience. Now, that's all I'm going to say for now. We have a few minutes for questions. We actually have a fairly long time for questions. But does that make sense to you all? Uh-huh. Is this anybody else's experience? Uh-huh. Anything like that? Yes. Do we want to have any personal testimony?
When I went to college, I studied the sciences, and I really struggled with how do you integrate both, the Christianity and the sciences. And it wasn't until going to seminary that I started integrating that, and I needed to integrate that because it was like I had this dualistic nature that I was very uncomfortable with. And I was also very uncomfortable with the fact that science has always been seen as an enemy of faith and religion, and vice versa. And so I needed to integrate that within myself, so,
Anybody else struggle?
I had a lot of similarities with you. One of the things I did in the 50s, with all this rationalism, is when I was studying theology, I finally started reading fairy tales on my own.
Reading fairy tales?
Which I found more theologically stimulating than the stuff that was going on in class. So I had an antidote at that point. But then I had a wonderful old man as a mentor who was an Old Testament professor, retired. And I remember the phrase he beat into my head was, he did not allow me to ever say, I feel that.
That you could not say, I feel that.
Studying the New Testament, I feel that Paul, oh no.
Well, I think.
I think that. And I loved the man dearly, and I learned a lot from him, but I think I had already had enough of the antidote reading fairy tales.
He can say what he wants.
And then I kind of breezed over that and went on my merry way. It's interesting how our generation had that from you.
Oh, yeah, we really did. Well, my students still, I teach in a seminary, a Methodist seminary, and they have probably the hardest thing for them is if they are given a doctrine and say, okay, where does the rubber hit the road on that? What is that actually about in your own life? And they just look blank. What do you mean? What do you mean? Well, God is the creator. Well, that God's the creator. What do I have to say about that in my own life? One of my favorites that I try out on them, I don't know why I do, I must have a slight masochistic streak, is they like to talk about sin. So I say, well, tell me about sin in your own life. Give me an example of a sin. They look blank. They can say, well, murder, that's a sin. Well, stealing is a sin. Well, yeah, but, you talk a lot about sin. Let's talk about particular sin. And it is because still a lot of us have been so well trained to keep our personal piety separate from the categories through which we actually see the world, that don't make the connections. We could go through the creed, one of the creeds, and talk on each one of the articles in the creed. What is that actually about in our lives? It would be very useful.
One of your memories kind of stimulated one of my own, and I remember I grew up in a church that came out of the Baptist tradition. And I remember when I was in our church, baptism was something you did when you, and I guess the minister, determined that you were ready. It wasn't done as at birth. And I remember, in part of it was you had this private interview with the minister. And I remember asking him, how do I know I'm saved? Because this was what one of the things that you were supposed to confess. And what I remember is he couldn't answer that question.
Did he give you, he must have given you some answer. Did he just say, I don't know?
It was just kind of like, well, you just know.
You just know, okay, just yeah, know. Yeah, yeah, you just know.
But I didn't know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I remember, too, our summer camps, always at the end of each evening, it was kind of an altar call.
Uh-huh.
And I would see people go up there, and all they would be crying.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, maybe I ought to try going up sometime and see...
If you felt like crying.
And I went up, and I didn't, and I felt really foolish, because then, of course, they always have an older woman or man to come and talk to, and it's like, well, I didn't know what to say. So obviously, I couldn't be saved, because I didn't have that experience.
And if you're not saved, we know what that means.
You feel frightened.
You're frightened.
I'm guilty.
But you're not sure what for. Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
You know, I really enjoyed this, specifically this one thing you said about it's all right to think.
It's all right to
and
think.
And to think things through all the way to the end.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And because, and the whole thing about connecting. The emotions, the intellect, because where I was growing up, I wasn't allowed to feel anything, period.
Mm-hmm.
So it's taken me a long time to get in touch with myself, to know who I am, and somehow through that, being able to integrate that with who God is.
Mm-hmm.
Because by denying altogether who I was, I could never get to where God is because I had no avenue to get there.
Mm-hmm. That's really important, what you just said. Did everybody hear that? It's really, she said, by having to deny who she was, she had no avenue to get to who God was.
Mm-hmm.
And see, and I think this is what happens, that when we deny every part of ourselves that we deny, cuts us off from a corresponding part of who God is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other thing that she said that was really important was how important it was to her to be told to follow your mind all the way to the end, to think through your problems, not to be afraid of that. And see, the theological reason why we don't need to be afraid of that is that we profess and believe, I certainly believe this, that I feel like I've learned it from experience. It's not just I was told to believe it. That all of creation somehow mirrors who God is.
Mm-hmm.
That God the Word informs all that is. Now, if this is the case, if all that is mirrors who God is, there isn't any way through knowledge you can step outside of who God is. You can't do it. Even if you want to, you can't do it. All you can do is re-describe it and say, well, this isn't God. But the fact is, you can't get to the limit of your mind and say, if I go over this point, I won't be there with God anymore. Our minds, we are made in the image of God. Our minds reflect who God is. And they are made to take in the world we live in. You know, they correspond with the world. So we do not have to be afraid of it. Because whatever we know, whatever is real knowledge, is knowledge of God. Even it's knowledge of physics or chemistry or the social sciences or geology or psychology or literature. All real knowledge is in fact knowledge of God. Yes?
Well, this is just something that has disturbed me, and I don't know that you can answer. I mean, it's not really a question.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a friend who was raised Roman Catholic, and
mm-hmm.
she's about my age, and when she became around the age of 40 or so, she decided she had to get a PhD in physics.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she did. And that was great. But then she said as a result of her studies, she really is convinced that there is no God. And has kind of, you know, just walked away from her other beliefs. And of course, you know, there wasn't anything I could say. It was like she's privy to stuff. Well, hey, if you would study this stuff, then you would know there's no God. And, you know, there was no responding because I, of course, didn't have a PhD in physics.
Mm-hmm.
But I know there are people who do who would say, yes, there is a God. So,
In fact, it's a quite common response of scientists to say, the world is so infinite and complex, and the universe is so complex. There isn't any other explanation. This couldn't just have happened accidentally. I mean, it's not a position that goes with being a scientist anymore necessarily. My own guess was, if you have a person that's gone through that kind of a change, is that they were somebody having a very hard time with their religion in the first place. That they were probably struggling with something analogous to what I was struggling with. You know, it may have been at a different point that they were struggling.
And she may still be in progress.
Well, we'll hope that she's in progress, because sometimes people just cut off their progress. I have a friend who is now 75, he's just turned 75, who was Roman Catholic, fairly liberal Roman Catholic. From the time he was a child, he converted as a child from Episcopalianism. But he was a very well-known medieval historian and scholar of the medieval liturgy. Wrote the standard works in there, and then he's just someone who was passionately committed to Christianity. And in his 50s, he finally admitted to himself that he was gay. And he was someone who was married, and he had seven children. He lost two of them, one by accident and one in an accident, one from leukemia. And he just realized he could not live in that situation any longer. And he ended up divorcing. But he also ended up with an incredible bitterness against the church, who had told him over and over and over that gayness was not an option. You know, that was a sin, and that wasn't possible. And his bitterness at the church translated into deciding he was going to be an atheist. And here he is, 75 years old, still says he's an atheist. And it makes me very sad. Now, it makes me sad for him. I'm not worried about his eternal salvation, because I think that it's much harder to get rid of God than that. And that you can decide you're an atheist, but God can tell the difference, you know. And he lives, you know, a life of Christian love. There was everybody that did. And but it makes me sad for him, because it still causes him so much suffering. But his atheism, see, is completely connected with his experience there. You know, it has nothing really to, you know, well, you can see, I've told you the pieces. Put it together yourself. Well, it's 11:30. Time to quit. Would anybody like to take this book and put it on reserve? Or
I would like to just put the ordering information out of it. Okay.